This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I want to talk about three things tonight. The first and the most important is I want to talk a little bit about why it is that Paris seemed to work when so many earlier negotiations really failed. I, as a graduate student, started going to all of the negotiating sessions that led up to the Framework Convention on Climate Change. They started in the late 1980s, really about 1990. I went to every single one. I went to COP1, which was in Berlin, chaired by their German environment minister at the time, a woman named Angela Merkel, who's in a different job now. I went to COP2, which was in Geneva, and then I stopped going to COPs because they struck me as a complete and utter waste of time. Because it was, to me as a political scientist, it was obvious that the strategy that they were following was going to fail. It was a strategy that was that involved countries getting together and trying to set centrally determined commitments to control emissions, and commitments that only applied to part of the world, not the entire world. And yet all countries were involved in the negotiations, which meant that all countries had to consent to what was agreed to. And they were organized around legally binding agreements, which meant that the consent not only was a consent in concept, but also consent under international law. And it struck me as obvious that that process was going to produce either agreements that looked good on paper, but didn't actually require anybody to do anything different from what they would have done otherwise, which was the Kyoto Protocol, or they were going to produce, if we actually tried to get ambitious, they were going to produce deadlock, gridlock. And that's what happened in Copenhagen. Copenhagen, to me, was depressing experience watching it from afar, but it was like a shock to the patient. And the entire patient convulsed as a result of this shock. And people started looking at new ideas. People in the university world started looking at new ideas. And my work over many years had been looking at alternative strategies that looked at other areas of international cooperation that have been much more successful, like international trade negotiations, international economic coordination, a variety of other areas. And so with a colleague, Robert Cohane, who's an international relations scholar at Princeton, and I worked on a series of papers, one paper in particular, that laid out the view that international cooperation was going to work in this area if we didn't think about it as a centralized top-down process, but as a more decentralized and a bottom-up process. And that, in fact, is what we were observing. We were seeing lots of different activities. And so even with gridlock in the formal UN-based negotiations, there were lots of other things going on. And so we did what good academics do, which is we published that in an obscure journal, and then we went on to whatever the next paper is that we were working on. When the patient was convulsed after Copenhagen, another really interesting group got very focused on this, which is the group that ultimately led the negotiations in Paris, which is the French Foreign Ministry and the French strategy. The French do not get enough credit for what happened in Paris, because in addition to the fact that they were diplomatically very skilled, the French Foreign Minister, Fabius, hired somebody who had read all the literature in this area and went back to the academic literature and developed for the French not only a diplomatic strategy that involved French diplomats on airplanes all the time for 18 months leading up to Paris, but also had a concept of what they were trying to achieve. And as scholars, we always look for ways that our work is relevant. And when the person that Fabius hired to lead and develop this whole concept gave a little talk in Davos this year in Switzerland in January, a few weeks after the end of the Paris conference, she said, you know, we looked to various places for the intellectual guidance as to what we were going to achieve. And the first place we looked was this paper that you, David, and Robert Cohane wrote. And I can say as a scholar, that was a really profound experience because you start to see the impact of your work on how people design international institutions that ultimately are, I think, going to be a lot more effective. I think one of the reasons that people are excited about Paris and less excited about most of what's gone before Paris is because the new Paris process is not centralized, integrated, top-down. It is more bottom-up. So in the months, years to some degree, mostly months, leading up to the Paris process, every country, and almost every country on the planet, was asked to write down, what are you going to do? And because a simple idea like, what is your pledge, can never be left with a simple name, those became called the Intended Nationally Determined Contributions, or INDCs. But the idea was a pledge. So instead of coming to Paris and negotiating centrally all the commitments, countries will say, here's what we're going to do, and we're going to try. We don't know what's feasible, what's not feasible, but here's our pledge. And the United States made a pledge, China made a pledge, India made a pledge, almost everybody made a pledge. I don't think the North Koreans made a pledge. They're busy doing other things right now. But this bottom-up process is part of the reason why people are excited about the about Paris, because although it's a difficult, messy process, it's a process that is likely to stay better connected to what countries are willing and able to do. So that's the first thing I want to say, which is in terms of the design of international institutions, this is really new. It took us a long time to get there. It struck me as kind of obvious that we should have gotten there in the early 1990s, and I'll talk more about that at the end. But now, finally, we're there after 21 of these COPs. And the reason I went to Paris is because I wanted to see this process, and I wanted to see what was actually happening on the ground. The second of the three things I want to talk a little bit about is about the role of clubs or groups, small groups of countries, because part of the French strategy and part of the strategy that comes out of basic international cooperation theory is that if you've got a hard, complex problem where even if countries are acting in good faith, they don't know exactly what they can do, that working in a big group of 180 or 200 countries is not going to be effective. It's too complex. You got to work in smaller groups. And so part of what the French government did brilliantly is they took that logic and they embedded that logic into an agreement that applies to all countries. So all countries are there. Think of the Paris Accord as a kind of umbrella. But then under that umbrella, they're free to go off and work in smaller groups. And actually, most of the progress in the months leading to progress came not from the big negotiations, but from the small groups. And in particular, I want to call out, we used to call these small groups coalitions of the willing, and then that got used for another event, didn't work out so well, and so we call them clubs or groups, and small groups. The group that I want to call out in particular is the relationship with the United States and China. The agreement that was signed in November of 2014 between the United States and China marked a way station in a process that's been developing over many years, whereby these two countries are both number one and number two in terms of emissions, and they also have the largest potential impact on the design of international cooperation in this area. And interestingly enough, both these countries are deeply suspicious of the centralized top-down process. They want something that's more flexible. They want something that they can better tailor to their individual needs. And so that bilateral relationship, the G2 relationship between the United States and China, really determined a huge amount of the direction and shape of the Paris process. And I think it's a real testimony to the French government that the French designed a process that created room for lots of small groups within this larger umbrella. And when you look closely, when you think about that and you apply that lens to what's happening, what you start to see is small groups everywhere. You have the United States and China. You have Norway has led in a tremendous effort to provide funding to countries, Brazil, Indonesia, now several others, who are reducing deforestation. Actually, this is the most important bright spot right now. You look at groups of countries working not just on all the different pollutants, but smaller numbers of pollutants, in particular an area where Ramanathan and I have been doing a lot of work together on soot emissions. Soot is politically a beautiful pollutant. And the reason it's a beautiful pollutant is because it causes lots of harm to people immediately, which means that even if people can't get their head around the idea that the slow buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over many decades or generations is going to cause harm to them eventually or their children eventually in some other country, they do get the idea about soot and local air pollution. So the politics of controlling these shorter-lived pollutants that have more noxious immediate impacts, the politics are easier to manage. That doesn't mean you can stop global warming by working on this, but if you think the biggest problem we've had over the last 20 years is building credibility in the international institutions that we're actually making progress on these kinds of problems, that working on these short-lived pollutants is an area where you can start to build that credibility. So you have all these different groups on certain pollutants, certain different geographical groupings, and so on, and that has been a tremendous source of energy and success. I just want to call out the Chinese in particular. There's probably no single country that has done more over the last 4 to 5 years to change its rhetoric and its engagement with the international negotiations in a way that has actually made it much more comfortable for lots of emerging economies to now become involved in this process. The Chinese are not comfortable as a diplomatic strategy in being in that kind of spotlight, but they played a major role. It's one of the reasons why I think this is actually one of the big wild cards going forward, is what's going to happen internally inside China. Because when I look inside China, what I see is a country that's led by people who are struggling with their grip on power, and that, as a general rule, doesn't lead people to invest in long-term global public goods. But that's an area of some uncertainty and anxiety about the future. The third and the last thing I want to talk about, I talked so far a little bit about why Paris was different from Copenhagen and some of the positive elements of that. I've talked a little bit about working in small groups and not just big groups. Last thing I want to say is about what remains to be done. I am cautiously very optimistic about the Paris process, and that is hard for me to say because the last book I wrote was called Global Warming Gridlock. The book I wrote before that was called Collapse of the Kyoto Protocol. So there's not been like a theme of optimism in my writings in this area. I'm cautiously very optimistic, but I just want to underscore that the way we got to zero brackets, to no disagreements finally in Paris, is by agreeing not to talk about the things that are really, really difficult to get agreement on. And now those are still on the agenda. In fact, if you look at the final decision in Paris, about one-third of it is the Paris Agreement with the flowery language and so on, and two-thirds of it is the action plan of all the things that haven't been done. So, for example, what they created in Paris with these pledges is what international relations people sometimes call a pledge and review system. Countries make pledges, and then they come back after a few years, they review what's happened, they ratchet, they adjust their commitments, they learn what they're able to do, they learn what they can't do, they make changes, they go back, they talk to other countries, and then cooperation emerges bottom up. It's the way most of the international negotiations on trade have operated very effectively in this way. Well, we've created a pledge and review system. The problem is we've got pledges, most of which were like a graduate student facing a term paper deadline. They arrived at the last moment, and there's no review mechanism. So the review mechanism needs to be created, and a whole series of other things need to be created in order to bring Paris kind of fully into effect. I'm concerned that we now have no conspicuous deadlines, no world leaders showing up on somebody's doorstep, no government who's devoted their entire foreign ministry, basically, to working the problem. And that concerns me, and it should concern all of us, not to the point of kind of inaction, but it means this is an area where people in the university and academia can do practical work on how to make the post-Paris process actually effective. And by closing, I just want to say, we brought with us a bunch of students to Paris. And to me, that was the most interesting part of the process, because many students, they do research. They say, you know, we've learned from our research that 2 degrees of global warming is really dangerous, or it should be well under 2 degrees, or people should do this, they should protect the oceans, whatever. And then you go to these negotiations and you see firsthand why it's hard. And it builds an appreciation for how are we going to develop strategies to manage, to engineer, if you like, those political barriers to make progress. And I think what you're going to see in the coming years is progress being made in small groups, in decentralized ways, and that's how international cooperation is actually going to unfold. I think the bad news on that, the good news in it, is that we're now finally getting something done, albeit 25 years after these negotiations began. The bad news in that is that we've locked in a lot of warming, a lot of climate change, that's inevitable. And I think that's why, among other things, it's very important what Scripps is now doing to build up research on what are the likely impacts, how would we anticipate them, how would we manage them. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.